We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're very glad to have you listening. In this hour of the show, we will return to a subject we certainly have talked about quite a bit on the program, and that is global climate change. And our guest for the program is David Orr. He's the Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics at Oberlin College. He is the author of a number of books, among them The Nature of Design, Ecological Literacy, The Last Refuge, Earth in Mind, and a recent book that is titled Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse. It is published by the Oxford University Press. He's visiting here in Champaign-Urbana, and his visit is sponsored by a couple of units on the campus. And just one time, I want to mention everybody that was responsible for bringing him here. They include the Departments of Urban and Regional Planning, the Office of Sustainability here at the U of I, also the cities of Champaign and Urbana, the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission, and the Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District. So thanks to all of them for making it possible for David Orr to be here. In his book, he notes that there are surveys that show that growing numbers of Americans indeed believe that climate change is a serious issue and that we should be moving away from fossil fuels and toward green sources of energy. And he says, well, that's good news, but we certainly can't stop there. In fact, he says that the challenges ahead will be far more difficult than the public has been led to believe. He says, while economics and technology are certainly important, both as causes and as solutions to this issue, he says the crisis that we face now is primarily a political one. It's a political challenge, and he says that it is a challenge that so far government has failed to meet. Questions are certainly welcome. We'd like to have people in on the conversation. We hope people will be brief and they will be on the topic. That way we can get in as many as possible. But certainly questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you can also send us email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
David, thank you.
You know, I have talked with a lot of people on the subject, and I think I have probably spent some time with a number of books, but I think I have to say yours is I don't know what word I want to use. It's the toughest. I think it's the most frightening, the most uncompromising book on this subject, I think, that I have ever seen. And that's it's a tough. I'm sure it's a tough message to try to put out.
Well, it is, and there is something like a Grand Canyon chasm from the scientific discourse on the issue to the public discourse, and what ought to bridge that is political. Institutions and organizations, and they fail to do it. And so what the scientists say, people like Jim Hansen, and what's in the fourth report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and then the public discourse in Washington and out on most airwaves are completely different subjects. And so the book, Down to the Wire, is an attempt to try to bridge that and say some things that need to be said in the public discourse.
Well, that's one of the basic points I think you make is the questions you raise is what do you tell people to get across to them in enough of the science so that they can understand, but also to put this in a way that says, look, this is very serious. What we've done to this point, not only is that an issue, but even if today we started aggressively to deal with the issue, what we have done already, those effects will be carrying forward into the future for a very long time.
Well, it's a devilish problem because what comes out of our tailpipes and smokestacks has a 30-year lag before it shows up as climate change-driven weather events. And so the weather anomalies we're breaking climate records at a record-setting pace. Twice as many on the warming side as on the cooling side. But, for example, last summer heat wave in central Russia around Moscow, that was off the chart warmer. That was 15 degrees Fahrenheit above what's their normal temperature. Pakistan, a city in Pakistan last summer hit 128 degrees. That's a record for South Asia. And so records are being set virtually everywhere. But that's a result of what we did 30 years ago. And so what the public needs to understand, and we need, you know, we propose that in the book I described the attempt to get President Obama to use the White House as a bully pulpit, but to talk about this issue with some passion. We're now at about 392 parts per million CO2, have never been there since humans have been on the planet. And if you run the film fast forward to the end of the century, there is a good likelihood, according to one report that just appeared in Science magazine, of Earth temperature being 15 degrees Fahrenheit, not centigrade, but Fahrenheit warmer by the end of the century. That would be unprecedented. And that's the global average. It would be hotter here because that averages temperatures in the ocean as well as on land where the temperatures will be higher. So what do you tell the public? You know, Mark Twain once said, you tell the truth, it'll amaze your friends and confound your enemies. But the truth of the matter is we've got some hard times coming ahead. And the science says that Susan Solomon, in a report to the Proceedings of the Academy of Sciences, said that we've got about 1,000 years. If you stop emitting greenhouse gases today, there are 1,000 years of warming temperatures and rising sea levels. Maybe it's 2,000, maybe it's only 750 years, but this is a civilizational crisis. And I don't know what you tell the public. You don't want to paralyze the public, but on the other hand, if I change the analogy and you go to the doctor, you don't want to go to the doctor and have the doctor sugarcoat what could be a fatal illness. You want to hear the truth as best he or she can speak it. I think the same is true on climate change.
Yeah. One of the things that you've said I think is interesting, and maybe that suggests that where some of the difficulty lies is that this is a kind of thing that has crept up on us, and that as human beings, we're not real good at perceiving that kind of threat. Something jumps in our face, okay, that we can deal with. But the thing that creeps up on us, it's like the old cliche about the frog in the pot where you steadily raise the heat. We're really not very good at that. And this is something that has been inching up and up, even though people for maybe a couple of hundred years have understood the greenhouse effect and they have talked about this. Our awareness of this, I'm not sure now how many decades we really have been paying attention to this now.
Well, you know, we 2007, we launched an effort that was called the President's Climate Action Plan. It was an attempt to lay out a climate policy for the first 100 days of the next U.S. administration, be it Democrat or Republican. And in the research for that, we found that the first warning given to a U.S. president was given to Lyndon Johnson in 1965. And so effectively half a century later, we still have no de jure climate/energy policy. And we have been inactive on what is conceivably the largest issue humankind will ever face. And there's a lot of skepticism in the public. And I think it's hyped by the media that has done a miserable job at equipping the public to understand a complicated issue that is of surpassing importance, as well as the opportunities connected with it. But the public misunderstanding of the issue or confusion about the issue is rather like the confusion that accompanied cigarette smoking for years and years. And some of the same people are involved in this well-funded denial effort. But the science on the issue is, by and large, pretty well completed. If you put heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, you trap heat. That's simply a physical fact. If you put a lot of them there, you'll trap a whole lot of heat. So when people say, do you believe in climate change? Well, if you believe in Moses or Jesus or Buddha, that's a matter of faith. But no one says, do you believe in the law of gravity? That's simply physics. And so climate change is simply atmospheric physics and mm-hmm. chemistry. It's not a matter of belief the way matters of religion are matters of belief.
And the mechanism, that is, if you add these heat-trapping gases to the atmosphere, that's they're going to do just what it sounds like. And that's something that we've known about for that mechanism is something we've known about for how long?
Well, it goes back a ways, but by 1898, a Swedish scientist, Svante Arrhenius, had pretty much done the hard scientific work that connected the carbon loading of the atmosphere with the actual temperature. He thought that carbon, you know, being a Swede, he thought the carbon loading was a good thing. It would warm things up a bit, but His numbers that he developed are ballpark accurate, but the issue is that as understanding of climate physics and so forth went forward in the 20th century, became clear that as you turn the thermostat of the Earth up, you change everything. This isn't global warming so much as it's planetary destabilization. Everything that you assumed about storms and weather and ecologies and so forth, all that changes. So it isn't just a matter of raising the temperature a bit. It's not like the temperature goes from 76 to 78 in a given day. It's rather that your odds of having big storms hit or long droughts or prolonged heat waves and certainly rising sea levels and larger cyclonic events or hurricanes, those odds go up dramatically. And so the summer that Chicago had, what was it, in 1995, the great heat wave hit Chicago, that by mid-century will simply be the norm in Chicago. As you warm and the warming becomes, the baseline shifts upward. And so the world that we're preparing for our young people, and this is not a matter of particular, there are lots of unknowns about climate change, but the basic science is well understood. And the basic conclusions are beyond refute. It's very, very similar to the cigarette smoking. You know, scientists knew in the 50s and 60s that smoking cigarettes was connected with heart disease and lung cancer. And the same is true now on climate change. But the public, there's this gap between the scientific what scientists know and what the public seems to believe about it is pretty wide.
Our guest in this hour is David Orr. He is professor of environmental studies and politics at Oberlin College. He's also senior advisor to the president of Oberlin. He's authored a number of books, including the book Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse. It's published by the Oxford University Press. We do have a caller here, and others who are listening are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also email your questions to will-talk at illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Piatone on our toll free line. It's line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in this book because it's kind of contrary to what I studied in college 20 years ago. It's my major was natural resources, and all the stuff that everybody seems to be talking about out there is kind of half-truth, I think. I don't know. What I was told, you can find this in just about any science book anywhere. You study the rocks. You study some of the stuff out there. If you're a geologist, they'll tell you, you know, that the Earth tends to do things in centuries and not decades, which people seem to think it does. We've only studied this with the good equipment and good base for 100 years. What bugs me is that all these people are out there saying we're in dire need, we're killing each other off. Now, I do grant it. I used to work for a federal agency and the National Park and Forest Service, and I've seen what people have done to our parks and forests. It's horrendous. But at the same time, you know, are we going to – everybody wants us to quit driving, period, quit driving. We're all going to get on our bikes and go 100 miles a day, you know. It's not going to happen. Until somebody comes up with an idea that is going to at least put people to work, at the same time it's not going to cost a catastrophe as far as the way the economy is, it's not going to change.
All right,
it starts with recycling. It starts with not throwing things into the trash that we normally used to do. I agree with a lot of what you're talking about. But at the same time, this stuff would have to be studied for 200, 300, 400 years before we can really decide, because the Earth again changes.
Okay, you made a number of really good points, and there are points that we hear often. And let me give you a chance to talk about this basic point that people say: look, the climate goes in cycles, and they're very long cycles. So you know, maybe we're in a warming cycle now. How do we know that this isn't just part of the normal up and down, and that, you know, and maybe in maybe it'll take 100 years, but maybe it'll go the other way?
It's a good question. Into the caller, thanks for the questions. In terms of climate science, at the year 1880, the carbon loading in the atmosphere was at about 280 parts per million. We're now at about 392, and adding give or take 2 parts per million each year. In geologic terms, this is incredibly fast. This is not how Earth has worked. climate change. Climate has changed repeatedly over millions of years, but it's always been at a pace much slower. We're changing the climate and the atmospheric chemistry at a rate probably 1,000 times faster than ever seen in the geologic record. We're moving carbon from the crust of the Earth to the atmosphere at a rate that the Earth's never had to adjust to before. Your second point, which I think is a really good point, I don't think anybody's saying you quit driving, but there are smarter ways to do things. We can drive as the U.S. is now moving toward, and as China and Europe and Japan have already done, toward driving much more energy-efficient vehicles. We're now going from things like incandescent light bulbs to compact fluorescents to LED lighting, and in the process, improving the lighting quality and saving 90 to 95% of the cost and the carbon and the energy consumed. And so if you go down the list of things that are now technically possible and economically advantageous for us to do to save energy and therefore carbon, it's a long, long list. And then the employment, and I think the caller was right to mention employment. This is huge job opportunities for U.S. industries and so forth to both develop wind power. You're right now, if we purchase a wind machine in Ohio, the odds are pretty good. It was manufactured in Europe or Japan or some other place. Why don't we manufacture that equipment here? We once did. We were the leading manufacturer of wind equipment 40 years ago. We were once the leading manufacturer of photovoltaic equipment. Now we've ceded that market to the Chinese and the jobs associated with it. So the transition to a green energy economy is not only essential, it's also a huge economic opportunity. And so far, we're letting other countries beat us in the race.
Well, I hear what you're saying. At the same time, I think that you've also, though, said that you have some concerns about this argument that says, well, technology caused the problem. Technology can also solve the problem. And in fact, some people say, well, you know, this is really a golden opportunity for economic development, building industries, putting people to work, and having those be green jobs and green industries. And what I have heard you say and read you say is, well, you're not exactly sure about how far that can go.
Well, there's a... Yeah, and that's a good question. And there's an issue of what do you, in fact, tell the public?
Yeah. Okay.
And so on the one side, the science is pretty clear. We've loaded the atmosphere with carbon. We're now 392 parts per million. We'll be very lucky, according to most scientists, to stop it short of 450 parts per million. Well, you go back millions of years to find carbon loading at that level. And we hope that we don't trigger these slower carbon-forcing factors, most of which have a lot to do with methane, which is 20 to 22 times more potent trapping heat than carbon dioxide is. So you get into some real science here, but the bottom line is that we've already committed to a much warmer future. That's already been decided. There's not a thing we can do about that. We've committed that we're now moving ourselves out of the, if you're biblical about this, the only paradise humans have ever known, which is geologists call it the Holocene. And that was that 10 or 12,000 year period in which we became human. That's when our cultures and science, our histories, everything good and bad about humans emerged. And now we're moving into a very different climate era. That now is the fact. And the question is, what do you do about that? What I proposed in Down to the Wire is we, with wartime urgency, move to mitigate or to reduce carbon emissions as rapidly as we possibly can. So from 392 parts per million, we ought to be aiming, in the words of Jim Hansen, to something like 350 and then eventually back to 300. And we ought to do this with a sense of wartime emergency. But it's like in World War II when Detroit stopped making cars and began making tanks. The conversion was almost instantaneous. Do we have the capacity to run this economy and create jobs and so forth on renewable energy? I don't think there is a technical doubt in the world that we can do it. It is a political issue. And the worry now is about the federal government running deficits. Well, we're running actually two different deficits. The financial deficit, sooner or later, we'll figure that out. And it may take decades, but we'll figure that one out. But the other deficit is the carbon deficit. We're loading the atmosphere at about 7 to 8 billion tons per year stay up there. And that deficit won't go away. And unfortunately, that is not solvable the way we think of most problems being solvable.
So you're saying, yes, energy efficiency, of course, we should be as efficient as possible. Let's develop renewables. Let's do all that good stuff that's good for jobs, it's good for the environment, but that people need to understand that what we have, as I said before, there are consequences to what we have done already. So even if we started doing everything right and everything good today, it's going to continue to be a problem, and that people need to know that.
You know, this runs right smack into the American psyche. And so much about America has been about progress and optimism and solving problems. It's a easier sell for people to understand climate in places like China or in Europe, where they have ruins and testimony to human fallibility. In the United States, we still have glittering shopping malls and new developments, and we're still have a hard time believing that things sometimes don't turn out real well. And so the idea that we may have gone too far, that runs against a good bit of the grain of America, but it's part of the maturity of the people here. We've got to reckon with the way the planet works as a physical system. And one of the odd things to me about this is that if somebody comes down with potentially fatal illness, you don't call 1-800-RUSH-LIMBAUGH. You're going to want a doctor. Yeah. You want to want somebody whose walls are lined with degrees from the best medical schools around. At that point, you want good science. And you may want a second opinion, and you ought to get a second opinion. But you don't take a diagnosis that this could be potentially fatal and say, well, gee, that's a liberal view. You don't blow it off. And you're questioning the doctors, okay, what do I do to be healed and extend my life? But if it's merely the planet and the risks are for all time and for all, for everybody, then we accept science at a much, or no science at all, just opinions by people who never took a course in science.
Yeah, our guest this morning in this hour is David Orr. He's professor of environmental studies and politics at Oberlin College. And if you'd like to read more on his thinking on the subject, look for his book, Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse, published by the Oxford University Press. We have a couple of callers here, been very patient, and we'll go to Decatur next. Line one, right here. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah.
We have a representative here from Illinois to the U.S. Congress by the name of John Shimkus, who stood up before Congress, read from Genesis, citing the fact that he found a chapter point in that in Genesis that God would not allow global warming. I just shake my head in disgust. Some of these guys like this that have their hands on the livers of government. And how in the heck do we convince these people that they're dead wrong?
Well, I don't know. I saw that comment, and God, Jesus, Moses, Buddha may forgive our sins, but nature won't.
Yeah.
And there's no, there's a kind of remorseless working out of big numbers in the biosphere. And the scientists are telling us we are transgressing those numbers. So if this was an airline cockpit, there'd be red lights flashing all over. The altimeter would be going crazy, and there would be warnings and so forth. But we don't have a panel like that for planet Earth other than the work of standard scientists subject to peer review and having to replicate their results. And they are saying almost with one voice that the Earth is in serious trouble. We can dispute the exact point where we cross various thresholds that no one knows for sure. But there's nowhere in Scripture that God tells us that he will save us from our own foolishness. To the contrary, you can find a good many passages in Scripture, and particularly the Old Testament, where it's pretty clear that if you're a fool, you're going to suffer the consequence. And it is foolish to tempt natural systems at this point. We are where we have never been before. We have gone into territory where angels would fear to tread.
Well, here's a guy that apparently doesn't buy that and cites the Bible saying that, there is no global warming, we'll have to worry about it. And again, people who believe that type of thing, they're hard to turn around.
Well, they are, and I don't know how much energy we ought to put into trying to turn them around, because you can get there. Where we need to get is to a low-carbon future. And so if someone that really doesn't want to believe in the scientific evidence, that's fine with all the problems that poses. That's okay. But they need to understand, for example, that the energy market needs to shift dramatically. And the best economic choices we can make all are low-carbon choices and toward energy efficiency and deploying renewables. And I think all they need to do is pay attention to what China and Japan and India and Europe and so forth are doing. They're eating our lunch on renewable energy. And we are becoming a country that will depend on them for our high-tech equipment in a whole series of fields where we once led. We deployed we purchased a 100 kW photovoltaic array a few years ago. Our choice when we bought it was to buy it from Germany or to buy it from Japan. And the irony for me, I teach at Oberlin College in Ohio. 24 miles to the east is the Glenn Space Center, where a good bit of the scientific research on photovoltaics and manufacturing techniques was actually conducted. 50 miles to the west was First Solar, the largest solar manufacturing company in the United States, but they had sold all of their productivity for 5 years to Germany because they had a feed-in tariff. So I couldn't buy a photovoltaic array made in the state of Ohio, even though Ohio has been one of the bellwether places on scientific research and manufacturing for photovoltaics. So our money went to, in this case, it ended up going to Japan.
I want to thank the caller and go on here. We have another caller, Champagne Line 2. Hello.
Is that me?
Yes.
As Mr. Inge said at the beginning of the program, this is a topic that's been discussed a number of times on the program. And I haven't heard them all, but all of the ones that I have heard have been on taken the side that the today's guest takes, except for one. And I think that one, Lindzen from MIT, was there perhaps because as a result of a letter that I wrote several years now. And I would like, if you want to take the time for this, for Mr. Inge to discuss the reasons for this imbalance. Because no matter what people say, there are, in fact, many competent, degreed with diplomas on the wall, scientists who have a different point of view. I mean, this feeds into the perception that public radio is incurably left-wing. And one way to maybe affect that perception is to have different points of view. Thanks.
Let me interrupt and say this. This alleged imbalance that you refer to, I'm going to disagree with you about that. Naomi Oreskes, a historian of science, published a paper in, maybe not 2001 or 2, in Science Magazine, which is the premier U.S. science publication, on climate science. And at that point, she found 928 articles on climate change, not one of which disagreed with the basic assumptions of climate as humans as the primary driver of climate change. And now, if she were to repeat the study, it would be more like 1,200 to 1,500 articles. So it's 928 or 1,200 or 1,500 to zero. So if you live by the rigors of peer review, logic, data, fact, and evidence, and what you say about climate science has got to be peer-reviewed, then virtually all of the people, Richard Lindzen is not a climate scientist per se, virtually all the people that you could find in the journals where this is debated, and they're not left or right, they're just merely scientific journals where fact, data, logic, filtered through peer review and constant checking of data and sources is the currency of the realm. There really isn't much debate. There is a debate about, for example, the effects of clouds and the height of the clouds and the type of the clouds and so forth. There are debates around the fringes of this. But this is a little bit like a tedious exercise to go back and continually hash over, does cigarette smoking cause cancer? We know that it does. Does carbon loading the atmosphere change climate? We know that it does. And there is, it doesn't seem to me to serve any public purpose in the name of balance, and I've got quotation marks around that, to continually debate what we already know. It's like having a debate about the law of gravity. We know a good bit about the law of gravity. There may be some things we don't know. But let me make an assumption that, let's say that the 90% estimate that appeared in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 2007, that humans were the forcing agent behind climate change, is 50% wrong. But you and I, if we're rational, would not get into a car where there was a 50% likelihood of a fatal accident. You certainly wouldn't put your grandkids in a car where there was a one chance in 1,000 that they would be involved in a fatal accident. Yet here's a case where the climate science is overwhelmingly clear on this point, that at some point the loading of the atmosphere with carbon will work out very badly for us. And maybe the evidence is 50% off. I don't think it is, but maybe it is. But that still doesn't change the conclusion that we ought to take every measure possible to eliminate carbon fuels from our repertoire and switch to efficiency and renewables.
We're past our midpoint here. I have a number of other callers. We're going to give the airtime to them and to the guest. We'll continue and go next to Urbana, and this will be line number 3. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for your discussion. And I'm sympathetic with what I think are the dangers of putting more CO2, et cetera, into the atmosphere. But you quote the fact that China and Europe, in fact, are going into alternate renewable energy techniques to reduce carbon. But from all the numbers that I've seen, in fact, China is building, in addition to its renewable projects, it's building lots of coal-fired power plants as well. And most of the data that I've seen says there's no conceivable hope that in the next 30 years that renewables can take the place, for example, of what we're now using, fossil fuels and coal, which is a fossil fuel also, of course, to fix the problem. So we have a very basic problem here concerning our energy usage. And the question is, how do we get over that? I think most people who have looked at the numbers realize that it's a terribly difficult problem, and it'll take an economic revolution to change it. So I just want your comments about this.
Well, that's a really good point. Thanks for making it. I agree. And if it were left to me, and then down to the wire, I say this in the document I referred to earlier, the President's Climate Action Plan that we gave to President Obama. We made this point that we need to do this with a sense of wartime urgency. We need to aim for something like 80 or 90% carbon reductions, and you can put whatever year on it. I would start at about 2020 to 2030. We need to do this the way we went about fighting World War II. But you're right. It is a daunting challenge, and China is building reportedly one or two coal-fired power plants virtually every week. At the same time that they're becoming or they have become the number one producer of solar photovoltaic equipment and so forth. So it is daunting, and you're right. There's no China and India and Europe and so forth. They're not all good guys on this, but this is an issue where leadership, relative to the magnitude and scope of the challenge, hasn't yet emerged, and neither has have we agreed to a plan, certainly in this country, that would take us to where we need to be to stay in what I hesitate to call the safe zone, but a safer zone than where we're headed.
All right. I hope, again, that gets at the question of the caller, and we'll go next to, I believe, line 1, Champaign County. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
It's easy to be red or green baited, I guess, on this subject and the next hour as well. But it seems to me that a couple of things. I just wanted to react to a couple of statistics that I've heard about public opinion. But I do wanted to say also that the Shimkus business about religious certainty that I can't understand. But I think it's more of a driver, if you will, of public opinion than than we'd like to think. And I think it should be confronted fairly directly by someone, maybe, feel comfortable doing that. But this religious notion, I think, actually affects people who are progressive in other ways. Without, I don't want to psychoanalyze everybody that I hear talking about it, but there are people that you would think that wouldn't be clinging to this notion of it's not been proven yet, et cetera, except they're religious, and I think it underpins it in some way. It's more complicated than I wanted to say something about that. Two statistics. One of them about how many weather forecasters, who most of them aren't meteorologists, who don't have any credence in climate change as being human generated, anthropogenic. Anyway, so that's pretty astonishing, it seems to me. But corporate media pays for cheap people, I suppose, who don't really, all they have to do is look good and get the weather maps down right. Another thing, though, this is more awful, I think. There was one poll that showed that 40% of people polled, and I guess it was a good scientific poll, didn't know whether President Obama thought that human activity was a primary driver of climate change. Well, I'm pretty sure he does, but the fact that many people can't decide makes me wonder whether the strategy of talking about it as simply an economic issue, and of course you want to make the economic argument that there's green energy, green jobs, but if you don't confront the direct threat, and it's not a threat to many people in the world. People have already been dispossessed, and wars are being fought over climate change results. Could you get at a couple of those things?
Well, first of all, thank you. Very quickly, I don't think that religion necessarily takes you to the position of your representative Shimkus. I think that there are many people on from evangelical to liberal sides of religion that believe care for the planet is really important. On the weather forecasters, that is kind of astounding. But I think it goes to an issue that a good bit of the media is owned by corporations, and we have suspended the fairness doctrine that had been created by the Federal Communications Commission in 1948 so that no station or ownership network is required to present all sides of an issue. On public opinion, I think the public has retreated on climate probably as a function of two things. One is the economic downturn, which refocuses attention typically on economics and jobs and so forth, as it has done. And secondly, a pretty well-orchestrated campaign by the fossil fuel industries to confuse the public and convince the public that, in fact, science is not of a mind on this, when, in fact, they pretty much are. So there's some distortion in the media about this issue that is unfortunate.
Our guest in this hour of focus is David Orr. He is a professor of environmental studies and politics at Oberlin College, author of a number of books, including Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse, published by the Oxford University Press. We have some other callers, and we have about 10 minutes left, so we'll just keep on going and go next to Champagne and line number two.
Hey, good hearing you. And need some mathematic consideration of the idea of making agricultural source burnable fuels as being a reasonable thing to attempt. As far as I understand, developing ethanol from grain or even from sugars from cane and what have you it does nothing more than add a great deal of carbon dioxide. I've never seen alcohol fermented without carbon dioxide being popped out all over the place. Don't understand how the use of at least a bit more than a gallon of what we use as diesel or fossil fuel to dry the ethanol to the point where it can be burned in whatever we have as gasoline motors, which also adds more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. We have a 50-cent tax on ethanol from Brazil. We have a 50% government subsidy to the local producers of ethanol or more, which does another thing which I think is absolutely horrible. It produces an awful amount of dirty water and hot water at that. And then you can always go to the idea that diesel motors were actually run on agricultural waste oils, are using soybean oil in our modern diesel motors, really means you're screwing up the cleanliness of the fossil oil. That's enough to talk about, and
okay.
I hope you can respond to it.
All right, thank you.
Well, I think thanks for the question. I think they're very quickly. Ethanol raises two big issues. One is what scientists would call the net energy impacts, how much energy you put in to grow the fuels and how much you actually get out. And most of what I've seen is that the ratio is pretty close to zero. In other words, it takes about as much energy to put in as what you get out. The other issue in world grain markets, as ethanol production went up a few years ago, you're taking food out of people's mouths because those lands that are growing fuels, liquid fuels, are used to being food production. And so it's a real issue. And that's I don't think we want to put food and liquid fuels in competition in the market and drive the price of food up worldwide, which is what has happened. I think there are better ways to do it than that. Mm-hmm. So, but thanks for your question.
We have some other callers here, and next is Spring Bay, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'll try to make 2 points quickly. By what I hear with the sponsors for your trip to Champaign, local people there seem to be sponsoring your talk, and so a local result of this is zoning. Walkable cities, trying to cut down on our transportation. And so there are some local things that we can do, and I think that's probably a pretty good place to start. And then secondly, on the national level, they just debated in the House yesterday public financing of campaigns, and it seems to me that that's something that we need to do, and I'll get off and listen to your response on that. Thank you.
Well, I think the first one on zoning and livable cities, or walkable cities, as you put it, I think that's a great approach. And, in fact, the market is moving in that direction. Young people, when polled, essentially say they want to be in dense downtowns, where a lively downtown, and so walkable apartments or close in to areas that have coffee shops, bookstores, nightclubs, restaurants, and employment opportunities. In fact, that's the approach taken under the name of New Urbanism or Smart Growth Strategies. And, in fact, if you're in development, you're less likely now to put money into the standard suburban development that sprawled a good bit, land-intensive and transportation-intensive, than into more concentrated urban development because the market has shifted in that direction. I couldn't agree more about public financing. It is a huge issue. For me, I think that we ought to create the same separation between money and politics that we ostensibly have between the church and the state. Simply take money out of federal elections. And that would solve a lot of problems or reduce a lot of problems very quickly.
I want to try to get in an email here, someone who writes that they fully agree that the real problem here is political. Case in point, we're spending tens of millions annually finding a way to capture carbon dioxide and bury it in the ground, although we know that will burn 30% more coal to generate the energy needed to do it. Far cheaper and environmentally responsible conservation alternatives are ignored because of vested interests. And a listener wants to know, do you have any thoughts on the issue of carbon sequestration?
Well, I've got some thoughts on it. Most of them are negative. I think that carbon sequestration has to compete with efficiency and renewables. In other words, this should not be a standalone kind of thing. And so if the money that goes into carbon sequestration, which I think is a very iffy process, were to be fairly allocated, you'd put a lot of that money, perhaps all of it, into efficiency improvements and deploying renewables. Secondly, carbon sequestration has got to be permanent. You've got to find ways to keep it underground. You're basically taking the same volume of the oil and gasoline that passes through the U.S. economy and putting it underground every year. Huge volume of stuff. So that means you have to find locations for it. If you can't keep it there permanently, there's no sense in doing it in the first place. But effectively, it has to compete with efficiency and renewables at a price we could afford with the longevity and dependability that we have come to expect on the energy system. Carbon sequestration can't do that. What we're told is it would be 10 or 20 years before we have a proof of concept. But then we don't have really 10 or 20 years to get a handle on this problem. This strikes me as something that's kind of a make-work program for the coal industry and highly improbable at best.
Well, we are getting very short on time. I want to try to do at least one more call. We'll to Champagne Line 3. Hello.
Oh, I have a quick question, hopefully, and that is looking at the Earth. We have had many ice ages, and it seems to me that there had to be pretty significant global warming to end an ice age. So, and that's, I guess, what we would consider the givens. Now, they also now are able to take core samples in glaciers that are documented to be millions of years old. And so the other thing that I think is relevant is that apparently there are different levels of carbon being detected when they take these core samples of literally millions of years ago. Now, how could carbon get into this system in a way that would, I guess, end an ice age if in fact carbon is the way that the Earth heats up?
Complicated answer, and we don't have much time to give it. The core samples taken from Antarctica and Greenland go back about 600,000 to 700,000 years, and what they reflect is the atmosphere at the point where that particular snow fell, and as it fell, it trapped little air bubbles. Those air bubbles are a record of the atmospheric chemistry at the time that the snow was deposited. That record goes back about 660,000 years, give or take. The paleo record goes back farther, and you loosen the standards for evidence a little bit there, but we have a pretty good record of climate that goes back certainly over a little bit over a million years, and then if you loosen the standards a bit and infer from what scientists call a paleo record, it goes back a few million more. Carbon dioxide is the big driver in climate systems, but it is not the only driver. There is methane and other heat-trapping gases, methane trapped in seabeds is what are called methane clathrates, and also in Arctic soils and so forth. Methane is shorter-lived in the atmosphere, but much more potent in the short term as a greenhouse gas. And so some of the spikes in warming that we associate with warming episodes 50 million years ago and a bit sooner reflect the effect, apparently, of carbon dioxide raising the atmospheric temperature enough that it then released methane. But there are also other factors. It's the motion of the Earth, the spin of the Earth, Milankovitch cycles, and other kinds of things. So the Earth physics here are complicated, but carbon dioxide is the big driver.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll try to get one more. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I have to mention that coal is now perhaps the biggest power producer for energy, which is very bad in putting carbon into the air. You haven't mentioned at all nuclear energy, and I think there's a psychosis in the country against nuclear energy, and many scientists certainly believe that nuclear power plants can be made in such a way that they remove most of the dangers for radioactivity, even for waste, if if the research in the development of reactors goes forward. You haven't mentioned that at all. It could be a big baseline power source. Why haven't you mentioned it?
Well, thanks for raising the issue. I'll mention it now. I think that nuclear power, aside from anything else, has to compete in a market. And the fact is, the market wouldn't touch nuclear power. It's a very expensive way to boil water. And whether it can be made safe or not, and whether we can find ways to handle the hazards, the radioactive waste that come out of it, which we have not yet done, those are all on a long list of issues around nuclear power. But for me, the major issue is going to be how would it compete with efficiency and renewables and an incredible array of technologies that are now coming out of the lab and into the marketplace, part of a distributed energy system. And the market simply won't touch it. The market will deploy energy as it's doing 10 or 20 times more in wind and solar and efficiency improvements, which are robust, relatively risk-free, low-cost, can be deployed very quickly, much less regulatory hassle, and does not absorb capital out of capital markets and take it from education, roads, and other kinds of things. So nuclear power on just economic grounds alone is, to me, a huge loser.
I've got to jump in here. My apologies to the caller. I can't give you a chance to follow up because we're just at the end of the time. Our guest, David Orr, is Paul Sears, Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics at Oberlin College. He's authored a number of books, including Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Thanks very much.
David, thanks for having me.